Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Fulia Pinar. I'm here today with Megan Carney to talk about her book, Island of Hope, Migration and Solidarity in the Mediterranean, published by the University of California Press in May 2021, so very recently. Thank you very much, Megan, for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, at the New Books Network, we'd like to start with learning about our guests' backgrounds. So could you tell us about your background in anthropology and how you ended up writing this book?
Sure. So I was an anthropology major as an undergrad at UCLA, and that was nearly now 17, 18 years ago. And there was actually a stint of fieldwork that I was completing as an undergraduate. It was part of an honors thesis, and I had chosen to do my fieldwork in Italy because I had studied abroad there and I was learning Italian. I was an Italian minor. And the scope of my research at the time was looking at foodways and shifts from sort of people's shopping behaviors in Italy's very, you know, well-known open air markets to acquiring food through these supermarkets that had appeared only relatively recently. And it was during that stint of fieldwork and trying to understand sort of interactions in open air markets and interacting with vendors that I had a conversation, actually this instance of very explicit anti-Blackness. And at the time, I wasn't really familiar with that. That language or as like a theoretical framework. But I had asked one vendor who himself was a native of Florence and was part of a family that had been selling food in these open air markets for generations. I had asked him to just sort of elaborate on how he perceived interactions among vendors in the open air markets. And he alluded to some of the more sort of recent, like newcomers in these spaces who had a migrant background, these vendors of a migrant background. And he said something along the lines of, I'm not a racist, but when you're in my house, and sort of implied that there was a certain code, unspoken code of ethics among vendors that he felt these people of migrant background weren't adhering to. And it was this very like explicit sort of claiming of space within the market. And I walked away from that interaction then really sort of more interested in the broader politics of migration as they were unfolding in Italy at the time. But I didn't decide to pursue that line of inquiry, at least not in Italy at the time. So actually for my dissertation research, a couple years after that stint of fieldwork in Italy, I attended or enrolled at UC Santa Barbara in the anthropology program as a PhD student and decided that I wanted to study migrant women's experiences of coming to the United States from Mexico and Central America, and more specifically, trying to understand their experiences of food insecurity, both in their countries of origin and then also upon coming to the United States and caring for their families, et cetera. But I always, in the back of my mind, had planned to return to Italy and maintain research projects in both settings, both in the US and in Italy. And so around the time that I was finishing my dissertation, which was in like 2011, 2012, the Arab Spring happened. And obviously that pulled my attention. And upon finishing my dissertation and graduating, I started postdoctoral research in southern Italy, and more specifically Sicily, looking at the politics of migrant reception. And sort of the rest is history. I embarked on a multiple year project doing various phases of fieldwork in Sicily primarily. And in the process of doing this work, my editor with University of California Press, Kate Marshall, who had worked with me on my first book, she was listening to me talk about the project and could tell how passionate I was. And I didn't really have a cohesive idea yet for a book, but she suggested to me very generously, like, you should really consider developing this into a book project. And so here we are in 2021, and there is a book.
Yeah. So can you tell us about your participants and your methodology for this particular book?
Yeah. So unlike much of the contemporary literature within anthropology and related disciplines, ethnographies of migration, the sort of, you know, primary subjects in this book are not migrants. And I do say at one point in the book's introduction that I have explicitly chosen not to focus so much on the experiences of migrants, but with the caveat that it's extremely important that we bring migrant voices to the fore, especially in designing any kinds of policies that directly affect those who are migrating or those who have been displaced and have undergone dispossession. But in any case, the heart of the book is really focused on the experiences of those who are involved in various aspects of migrant reception in Sicily, which also includes many people of a migrant background, because inevitably those who migrate into Southern Europe, primarily through Sicily, many of them ultimately remain there and become sort of politicized or radicalized and desiring to be part of the broader network of migrant reception, but also these sort of corollary efforts to mobilize politically to advance the rights of migrants in Italy. So those are really like the primary subjects. Those are the folks that I'm writing about in this book. Which includes many Siciliani or Sicilians. And I don't, I want to just sort of preface this with a very clear statement of I am not in any way wanting to generalize or speak on behalf of all Sicilians. That is absolutely not the case. Sicilians are a very diverse group of people, very diverse histories, very diverse political sentiments and attitudes, especially on matters of migration. But by and large, my sample or those that I'm interviewing and talking about really reflect those who claim Sicilian heritage.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit more about the spatial aspects? So can you tell us about Italy's migrant reception system and how the migrant reception system is affected by the economic shifts in Italy and in Europe in general?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important to allude to sort of the deeper history, well, in the last couple of decades within Italy and Europe as it concerns migration. So migration through Southern Europe is not a new phenomenon. It has been unfolding or happening for multiple decades. And it's sort of always treated as an emergency. That's one of the primary critiques, is that Italy and much of Southern Europe does not have a comprehensive system of migrant reception. And actually, as some of my informants would describe, they say it's a non-system or a system of non-reception. And this isn't by accident either. It's not a broken system. It's working as it's designed, which we can come back to later. But so Italy has, it's sort of a frontline community. And within Italy, Sicily, being an island at the tip of southern Italy and very close to the African continent, Italy is really has been on the front lines of much of the migration that is occurring through the central Mediterranean. So arrivals of people by boat, interceptions or search and rescue operations happening in the Mediterranean, primarily by humanitarian organizations. Many of those that are intercepted at sea are brought to one of Sicily's various ports. So there's sort of this echoing among from Sicily and then from Italy in the broader context of the European Union that Italy and Sicily have been abandoned by the rest of Europe in responding to migration. And that Europe has not provided sort of adequate support, or the rest of the EU has not provided adequate support in responding to this migration. So you'll often hear sort of this refrain among many of Italy's politicians, and then also within Sicily, that migration is not an Italian problem, that the recent so-called like refugee crisis, as it's been framed by various different political actors, or humanitarian crisis or migration crisis, that these are not the unique responsibility or sole responsibility of Italy or Sicily, but that the rest of the EU is implicated in this phenomenon and should be sharing in responsibility. So in the last decade, much of the sort of response by Italy and also by Sicily to migration has been impeded by various waves of austerity. These austerity measures that have translated to significant cuts in public spending, including within the realm of migrant reception activities.
Yeah. What about Sicily's positionality in Italy?
Mm-hmm. So Sicily joined the was brought into very forcefully into the formation of Italy as a nation state in the mid 1800s. And Sicily, before that, had undergone sort of various phases of conquest and colonization by different groups. It's, you know, often talked about is like this melting pot of the Mediterranean. Sicilians themselves like allude to having this sort of mixed heritage from different phases of colonization and conquest of the island. But so Italy is sort of perceived as by many Sicilians as sort of the most recent colonizers of the island. And in many ways, the sort of contemporary political and economic conditions on the island speak to this deeper history of Italy's colonization. And it was Antonio Gramsci who talked about Sicily as being one of Italy's internal colonies from which the nation state extracted labor and also raw materials. And in many ways, those dynamics persist today. And so there's, even though Sicily has this like autonomous, semi-autonomous status, a few other regions also maintain the semi-autonomous status within the larger context of the Italian nation state. Sicily also is very much at the behest of Italian politics. So decisions that are made in Rome within Italy's central government do have direct consequences for the material realities of Sicilians. And so there's this struggle among those in Sicily to feel a real sense of autonomy, and also a struggle for their dignity. Italy has this very fraught history, sort of this division between the north and south. Southern Italians have been racialized and stereotyped. And Southern Italians are acutely aware, very aware of sort of the ways that the Italian nation state and to some extent the rest of Europe has employed these very orientalist discourses in talking about Southern Italy and Sicily. And it's sort of this means through which Italy and the rest of the EU asserts its dominance over the region and maintains this marginal status of Sicilians, and also is used to justify restricting sort of resource allocation or distribution to Sicily. It's used to justify the withholding of material resources and also other forms of support from the island.
Yeah, and in terms of managing migration, what kinds of roles and responsibilities are assigned to Sicily in managing the asymmetrical developments in Italy and migration in Europe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's long been said, like, Sicilians, those that I have spent much time with over the past several years, will say that, you know, Italy, talking about the central government and also those, their counterparts in the north, think about Sicily as responsible for its own problems. So, you know, that nearly half of Sicily's population is at risk for poverty, that organized crime continues to be a daily reality, primarily through La Cosa Nostra or mafiosi. And that sort of logic extends into the realm of migrant reception. So, many of those that I interviewed involved in various aspects of receiving migrants and helping sort of facilitate a process of integration feel that Italy has abandoned them to this task and that Sicily is, quote unquote, responsible for migrant reception. In some respects, I would say that actually for many, like, this is a source of pride that the rest of Europe is actually looking often to Sicily as a model or wanting sort of advice or guidance in how to facilitate migrant reception and integration. The mayor of Palermo, Leoluca Orlando, is like this globally renowned figure for being very open to receiving migrants and sponsoring many programs that are actually challenge policies around immigration enforced by the Italy central government. But on the other hand, Sicily is, like I alluded to, is struggling. You know, the material circumstances of many Siciliani, they are living in conditions of poverty. And thus also Sicily was particularly sort of brutalized during Italy's various phases of economic austerity. Actually rewinding a bit, so after the global financial crisis of 2007-2008, a few years after that, Italy was experiencing a very profound sovereign debt crisis. And there was a discourse at the time that Sicily was actually to blame for economic problems being experienced in the north. And so Italy did not refrain from implementing very severe austerity measures on those in Sicily. And so Sicily is still recovering from the fallout of those austerity measures. And that had a direct impact on the island's capacity to sort of adequately respond to more recent waves of migration.
Yeah, and you're showing that the neoliberal austerity measures in Italy are quite interrelated with the care labor and solidarity work for migrants in Sicily. So can you tell us a bit more about these relations between these neoliberal austerity measures, these roles assigned to Sicily, and how this shapes the activist realm?
Yeah, so one of the sort of primary theoretical threads throughout the book is thinking about affective dimensions of neoliberalism. And in the case of, I'm talking about the affective dimensions as they impact both citizens and non-citizens. So in the case of citizens, and more specifically Siciliani, there is this sort of sense of there's been this attempt to like cultivate them as indebted subjects. And in the case of migrants or non-citizens, they are sort of, many of them, right, have experienced conditions of illegality or been thrust into conditions of illegality. And both, so then both groups, right, are like pushed to the margins in different ways and conditioned to have a certain affective disposition. So I argue that many of the contemporary mobilizations around migrant solidarity, which index a politics of becoming in that they are aspirational. These are aspirational efforts. The project of migrant solidarity is an aspirational one, right? So something that people are striving toward, and it's sort of always imperfect and reveals its own sort of internal inequalities. But in any case, there is this motivation among both citizens and non-citizens to struggle toward something different in transforming their material and affective possibilities, mobilizing for political change, and sort of demanding and advocating for the dignity and expanded rights of all. So it's this convergence of the politics of austerity along with sort of the politics of migration where these groups converge and build coalitions.
Yeah. In chapter four, you're writing about the particular configuration of caring labor as sort of this migrant solidarity work. So can you tell us about what kinds of contributions does migrant solidarity work offer for the scholarship and social policies on care?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think, you know, we first probably want to make the case for this is the broader context of where migrant solidarity is originating from, or where these sort of mobilizations between citizens and non-citizens are originating from. And in the context of Italy more specifically, Andrea Muehlbach has talked about several years ago with her ethnography, The Moral Neoliberal, how Italy at the time had identified loneliness as this new challenge among Italian citizens. And one of the many crises within Italy right now, and sort of there's this anxiety or moral panic around, is stagnant population growth, stagnant fertility rates. And so essentially this is to say that the reproduction of society itself is at stake. And after, you know, a decade of economic austerity measures and inadequate responses by the state for addressing migration has left this, right, these feelings of despair, malaise among many of Italy's citizens and non-citizens. And so what I'm talking about in this book, what I'm trying to understand and analyze, are sort of these new spaces of care within the context of migrant solidarity, and how a caring labor is necessitated by these conditions, these converging conditions, all of which are really the result of neoliberal policymaking, racial capitalism. But then how is migrant solidarity an effort or attempt to reconfigure the social organization of care and to strive toward alternatives that will translate to the reproduction of society, but a society that is liberating for all. And so how, you know, I argue that these migrant solidarity efforts are not sort of detached from the broader context of neoliberal racial capitalism. In fact, they are very much articulating with, while also subverting, these logics. But essentially, I mean, they are sort of calling into question the very need for such types of caring labor to exist. And so going back to your original question, you know, how might these formations around sort of in the name of migrant solidarity translate to changes in social policies and such? That is definitely a focus or emphasis of these social formations. But I think first and foremost, the reasons that people are organizing and developing these coalitions is really for that the transformations in people's collective material and affective well-being. And so that's happening at the scale of communities, local communities. But nonetheless, anyone involved in that work still emphasizes the need for political mobilization that will lead to broader structural changes in the long term. But they realize like those are not so immediate and will take more time.
Yeah, and basically in this chapter, you're also telling us that the helping to migrants, migratory projects is also a part of this caring labor, this migration solidarity work. So you write on how activists are trying to help migrants actualize their dreams and hopes about their lives. So what does the word project entail here? Is it used in a similar way to that of NGO projects or research projects? Or is it like a counter project, so to say, about migrants' futures? Because you also mentioned the relationship between solidarity work and neoliberal austerity measures. So I'm wondering what does the project language sits here?
No, I think you're right. It is like a counter project, right? Organizing against oppressive forces. So the migratory project is not that which is like envisioned and imposed by the state apparatus, but rather more specific agentive desires for autonomy and belonging as defined and articulated by migrants themselves. That is a defining component of solidarity work, and those committed to it is helping to facilitate the realization of these migratory projects as best as possible.
Yeah. And if we move into the chapter 5, edible solidarities, so you look at some multicultural restaurants here. Can you tell us about how the forms of solidarity in these private establishments kind of shape activism and migrant solidarity compared to the voluntary activist networks that you're writing on in chapter 4?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I wanted to write about these particular efforts happening around food in Sicily, because for a number of reasons. One, because food has long been sort of recognized as a powerful space for political mobilization and building solidarities and multi-group coalitions, and especially in the Italian context. Italy has this history of solidarity purchasing groups, or gruppi di acquisti solidali. And it's also the birthplace of the slow food movement. So the establishments, these two restaurants where I was doing much of this research, one is in Palermo and one is in Agrigento. They create these fusion foods, combining culinary practices from Sicily, from Italy more broadly, and from throughout the African continent, as well as many of those who are working in these spaces also have migrated from throughout the Middle East. So what's really interesting about these projects is their explicit commitment to upholding migrant ways of knowing and spotlighting their culinary knowledge, making that really part of the identity of the restaurant itself. So people of a migrant background in these spaces have a very prominent role in the work that these restaurants are doing and the foods that they're producing. But they also, they're not just, as many of my research collaborators say, and specifically in that chapter, I highlight how they are always saying this is not just about the food. Here, that's about more than just the food. They put a really strong emphasis on, again, various forms of political mobilization. So they are writing, calls for solidarity that are published in the local newspaper, and meeting with local politicians, and actively supporting humanitarian organizations that are performing search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean. They have vocational programs. One in particular, this restaurant, Ginger, the head chef, Chef Marem, who actually was, who won the title, world champion title on sort of Italy's equivalent of Top Chef. But she created this project, Project Nora, which is specifically for women of a migrant background to learn how to work in kitchens and restaurants and develop careers for themselves. That will translate to improved material well-being for themselves and their families. So they have this explicit focus on migrant integration. And then they're also involved in work that has really nothing to do with food. They host various types of community events to bring various people in and share that space. One of the restaurants, the one in Palermo, is adjacent to this co-working space that that houses various organizations and groups that are involved in sort of advocacy work and social justice projects, and also human rights organizations. So they're both very unique, but doing very important work. And the ways that they are, cultivating these fusion foods is not, as I say in the chapter, is really not for the purpose of sort of appealing to a particular market niche and appropriating these foreign foods, right, for consumption by an elite class of consumers. That's not at all what they're about. I could say more.
Yeah. Can you tell more about what specific role does food play here then in creating these forms of care and solidarity? Because food mm-hmm. is also something about home, something about mm-hmm. belonging, those feelings. So can you tell us about the food part of this?
Yeah. So food is an important site of care. So in terms of thinking about like what these spaces are doing in reconfiguring the social organization of care, in prominently featuring foods that are really much informed by migrants' backgrounds, they're sort of challenging the broader, more hostile environment that is sort of anti-migrant in Italy. And they're also creating spaces for other forms of belonging and participation or even citizenship. So I talk about in this chapter how these spaces around fusion foods are promoting other types of citizenship, like social, cultural, economic citizenship, as an alternative to political citizenship. And this is really important given the contemporary sort of political climate in Italy and much of Europe, where the far right has made a comeback and is sort of dominating much of the national and conversation around migration. So food then is a space for promoting these other forms of belonging, but also as a site of care for nurturing social relations between citizens and non-citizens, and actively working toward these transformations in material well-being, affective well-being, that are not just benefiting the individual, but are translating to transformations in collectives, among collectives.
Yeah, amazing. And both of these restaurants, Multivolti and Ginger, I believe, we also see that there is a commitment to share one's destiny. And I would like you to talk a bit about this too. So how, like, what does the destiny, the language of destiny, entail here? Is it something timeless like fate, or is it something specifically about the future? Because the aspirations, the hopes, the future is like a great theme in your book. So I'm wondering, what does this sharing one's destiny mean?
Yeah. So these sites of migrant solidarity work are very much future-making projects, right? They are very much sort of grounded in alternative futures. And that's why I say they index a politics of becoming. They are aspirational. In the case of Multivolti and Ginger, they're cultivating this social capital that will translate to concrete acts of solidarity that assist all in being more resilient to future crises. So then sharing one's destiny is very much about redistributing risk among a collective, both now and into the future. In some ways, like, I think, to bring it back, I guess, closer to home here, in the US, and some of the anti-racist politics and social movements that are underway right now. And this talk about, you know, are you an ally or are you a co-conspirator? In the case of Sicily and these coalitions between citizens and non-citizens, there's a real sense of absorbing risk, right, within the collective, and not just being an ally to migrants and seeking to like advance their struggles against these broader structures of oppression and restrictive immigration policies and economic regimes that attempt to exploit them and extract their labor and withhold their formal belonging. But really for citizens to put themselves on the line as well, right? That there's this understanding that they are implicated in this struggle, and that no matter what, that they do share each other's fates. And that is felt in very like palpable material ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very collective approach. You're actually showing us an alternative way of existing as a human being as well, not just as activists or migrants, but as a human, really, to exist in something else apart from the individual.
Right.
And I'm wondering about the role that migrant youth involvement has here that you touch upon in chapter 6. So you specifically work on the migrant youth's involvement in creating films, other media forms, and activism in chapter 6. And can you tell us what specific role does their involvement play in terms of this kind of a solidarity and care work and this kind of an existence, really?
Sure. Yeah, I kind of posed this question in that chapter, Caring for the Future. I posed the question, to what extent are migrant youth accounted for or unaccounted for in migrant solidarity efforts? And I talk about a few different sort of initiatives that center on migrant youth. And in the end, I sort of conclude that some initiatives are more successful than others in advancing the rights of migrant youth. But there's a complicated history around governance as it pertains to youth. So I talk about the ways that migrant youth, not just in Italy, but around much of the world, are perceived by state and humanitarian actors often through this binary, like they're either victims that have to be rescued from these spaces of vulnerability where they are subject to exploitation by various different actors, or as a potential problem, as potential criminals that have to be rehabilitated. And so, in short, across these various sites of governance, migrant youth are very infrequently afforded autonomy and agency over their own fates. And there's also, you know, a sort of longer history about childhood, right? And you know, the moral, political dimensions of childhood. And so there are questions about to what extent are migrant youth able to make decisions for their own well-being? To what extent, or at what age is it appropriate for someone to migrate? And I think, you know, as an anthropologist, like, we can recognize that much of the ways that we think about childhood or youth in the US and also in Europe or in the global north is informed by this kind of Eurocentric framing of childhood and the moral and political dimensions of it. So anyway, these efforts that I talk about like a participatory film laboratory that exists for the explicit purpose of both foregrounding migrant narratives, and especially the narratives of migrant youth, and involving them in various media projects, specifically filmmaking, to bring their experiences to broader audiences who then might be motivated to mobilize on behalf of these youth, and also to demand broader structural changes to the way that Italy handles immigration. But also, this film laboratory is a vocational program. It exists to help facilitate the entry of people of a migrant background into the realm of Italian cinema, because you know, that exists as a professional field, and there are career opportunities therein. There's then, you know, I talk about some like group homes that exist for migrant youth outside of sort of the, you know, institutional settings that are more state sponsored, and how they are, you know, helping to integrate migrant youth and you know, some of the successes and failures that exist within those group home settings. And then I also talk about, yeah, actors like UNICEF, and the ways that they do a lot of speaking for migrant youth, and sort of still adhere to this binary way of thinking about migrant youth as victims or as potential problems, and not really affording them agency. So there's a couple of vignettes in this chapter that involve events that were sponsored by UNICEF. One in the city of Catania that was a fundraiser for UNICEF, and then this mock boat rescue that happened in Palermo, close to the port, that was held concurrently with the G7 meetings that were happening on the island at the time. And wanting to bring attention, the purpose of the event was really to bring attention to the ongoing tragedy of migrant deaths at sea, and specifically of children and youth.
So I want to ask you now about your the final chapter of your book. So the final touches that you made on the book corresponded to the COVID-19 process, which has been experienced in Italy with immense fear, panic, and restrictions. So I'm wondering, how did this process affect the care labor and mm-hmm. solidarity work in your field site?
Mm-hmm. Well, so Sicily was particularly at a disadvantage with the pandemic, much because of the lingering effects of economic austerity measures and the consequences of those measures for the public health and health system in Sicily. Many would argue that the health system was already on the brink of collapse in Sicily prior to the pandemic. And also sort of the economic crisis that has been worsened by the pandemic in Sicily. Many in Sicily labor primarily through sort of informal economic activities, and they were thus ineligible for economic stimulus payments and other forms of state-sponsored support that came with the pandemic. So many in Sicily were excluded from those forms of state support. And then also tourism is just one of Sicily's primary economic activities, and that has completely come to a halt during the pandemic. And so the poverty that was there already has in many ways been amplified by the pandemic, and there have been very legitimate concerns about organized crime stepping in to intervene in these crises, the economic crisis in Sicily right now in particular. So it was both sort of underprepared because of these policies that had been orchestrated by the central Italian government years prior in its health sector, as well as, stifled economically by the pandemic. And early on, there were really no cases of COVID in the region. COVID struck Italy more first in the north. A few regions in the north were particularly were hit significantly by the pandemic. It's been more since like last summer, when actually tourism picked up a little bit within Italy and then in southern Europe, that COVID cases then were rising. And it's only in like the last month that Sicily is no longer designated as a red or orange zone. As it's been, the system has been organized in response to the pandemic. And so Sicilians, for the first time in a very long time, have been afforded more mobility. They can leave their homes. They can be out in public. There is the vaccination program is underway, and many are being vaccinated. And while all of this has been happening, migration across the central Mediterranean has not really stopped. There are, to some extent, probably more people fleeing where people were migrating from before. There's been sort of a marked increase in that migration because of poor responses to the pandemic in many of these migrant sending countries. And yet early on in the pandemic, Sicily had officially closed its ports and was not facilitating any reception activities, specifically disembarkations. It continued to criminalize organizations, humanitarian organizations that were performing search and rescue operations at sea. Last summer, the regional governor of Sicily mandated that all reception centers housing migrants close and that migrants be transferred to other parts of Italy. Newly arrived migrants were being quarantined on cruise ships, just like a short distance off of Sicily's shores. And there was a lot of controversy around that. It's, of course, like all other ethnographers, I've been doing some, you know, observations remotely and staying in conversation with my research collaborators there to understand what their experience has been like during the past year or longer. And how sort of the conditions imposed by the pandemic, like how they've been able to continue practices of mutual aid and solidarity, and it's been challenging for sure. But those networks that have been cultivated in the last several years have proven to be extremely important for addressing people's basic needs. For helping to redistribute resources among collectives, like, you know, just like food distribution sites, communicating about, where people can access resources or get to sites of healthcare should they need it, et cetera.
Yeah, these are so crucial during this time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're continuing in a way, and they're becoming more visible in some senses with their help.
Yeah, but I mean, like the restaurants, for instance, that I document in chapter 5 of the book, talking about edible solidarities, like they, like all other businesses, they were forced to close their doors to in-person dining. But they were, you know, still sort of continuing with other activities. They were engaged in preparing meals and distributing meals to healthcare workers, to others in their communities who were, you know, lesser means. Yeah. And there have been, you know, lots of crowdfunding efforts to support these businesses while they've had to be closed.
Yeah, so they're still in business though, right?
They are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Glad to hear that. Well, thank you for taking us through your book and your thinking. I think we have taken up a lot of your time, so I will now move into my last question. So what are you working on now, or what would be your next project?
In Italy, I was supposed to be there right now, actually, on a Fulbright, for obvious reasons, had to postpone until next year. But I will be located at the Migration Policy Center, which is part of the European University Institute in Florence, and doing some work on food-related displacement and migration among transnational migratory networks between Africa and Europe, and convening various researchers from across Europe who are doing work on the intersections of food and migration and trying to develop more integrated policy responses as climate change translates to even more food-related, environmental-related displacement. And then During that time, I'm gearing up right now, collecting some data, but I plan to spend some time again in Sicily looking at recovery from the pandemic, sort of the afterlives of pandemic, and you know, the implications of the pandemic for solidarity efforts, for citizenship struggles, for changes to Italy's citizenship laws. And then there is the film lab that I mentioned. We've been in conversation for some time about doing a lab together that would include migrant youth working alongside students from my own university and then another colleague's university in the UK, in engaged collaborative research projects and alternative storytelling, participatory storytelling, primarily through short videos and film. So I hope that we can resume sort of planning for an iteration of the lab that includes students working with migrant youth together in these participatory ethnographic activities in Palermo.
Well, yeah, they all sound so amazing and very impressive. We'll certainly be looking forward to your next projects. Thank you very much, Megan, for your time, for joining us, and for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you so much. This is a great conversation. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. I'm your host, Fulia Pinar. This discussion of Island of Hope, Migration and Solidarity in the Mediterranean, published by the University of California Press, is brought to you by the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.